now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpit, here's Nick Perez.
Yes, and how's it? And welcome to the new era of eloquence and exposition. This is Life from the Pulpit, the fastest half-hour podcast in the West, live and local, on location at Merced Church of Christ, deep in the heart of the Central Valley, offering up news and views you can use on Scripture and society with a little help from my friends. I am your host for this half-hour journey into theology and other century matters, the voice of the Valley, Nick Perez. Greetings, welcome to the program. Okay, we ended chapter 16 with the seventh bowl being opened, the bowls of God's wrath. We're in Revelation chapter 17 now. And this is God pouring out his judgment and his wrath upon the nation of Rome. John, he's about to get a close-up of what God has been preparing for incorrigible Rome, her complete and final destruction. And John will describe God's judgments against her in detail. And your premillennial friends, they want to take hold of these later chapters in the book of Revelation and ascribe all these descriptive judgments to a great tribulation at the end of the world. But John is describing something much closer to his own time. As I've said, the book of Revelation is bookended by these statements that the time is soon. These things must soon take place. The time is near or at hand. This must find application for these first century Christians to whom John is writing in Asia Minor, seven churches there. It's fair to say that these judgments have eschatological value. I don't doubt that at all. But it's in the sense that they typify God's wrath against all rebellion. God's punishment of Rome says to us that there will be a final day of reckoning when God will totally and once for all be vindicated against evil. And we'll be vindicated with him. We get to rule with Christ and all those different things. Even now, we're ruling with him in the heavenly places. At least we're seated with him, Ephesians chapter 2. What about verse 6? Now, let's pick up the reading here. Verse 1 of Revelation 17. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality," fornication, "and with the wine of whose fornication the dwellers on earth have become drunk." So who is this great prostitute? There are some, even in our brotherhood, who want to say that this is Jerusalem. Again, your premillennial friends are just way out there on this, saying this is some kind of future, the Antichrist, or some future nation to rise out of the European Union. No. Our brotherhood, some say this is Jerusalem, but this description here does not fit Jerusalem. Seated on many waters, the waters, as we find out in verse 15, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. And to sit on these many waters, above these peoples, that's a sign of earthly authority. Ruling. Jerusalem had none of that. This must be Rome. The great prostitute is Rome. Or maybe your translation says the harlot. So John, he's already referred to Babylon back in chapter 14 and verse 8. He's talked about the second angel says, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." Chapter 18 now is detailing this. Chapter 17 and 18, I should say. He's recorded her doom. She's doomed because she's under the seven bowls of God's wrath. But again, who is she? She is Rome. She's the one who rules over the entire empire. She's the one who sits upon the many waters, the waters representing peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. She's the one who's committing fornications with the kings of the earth. In other words, the nations. All right, she's prostituting herself to the nations. Again, Babylon is the city of Rome herself. That's typical throughout the book of Revelation. This is judgment against Rome. So she's being judged for all these different things. The dwellers on earth have become drunk. They have drunk of the cup of God's wrath that is being poured out upon Rome. By the way, for more on the cup of wrath, Psalm 95, Jeremiah 51, Isaiah 51, Jeremiah 25, Jeremiah 51, Matthew 26, and also Revelation 16, as we saw in the previous episode. So there you have it. This is Rome. She's prostituted herself to the nations. And so John, notice he is carried away, verse 3. Carried away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. Interesting. 7 heads, 10 horns. Let me deal, first of all, John is carried away out into a wilderness, a desert place. And he is going to be given an objective view of this woman. And the picture that he receives here, just absolute moral decay. Verse 4 continues, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her fornication. So, terrible, terrible moral depravity, moral decay, all kinds of immorality, greed, licentiousness, corruption. And granted, that picture could depict a dozen other civilizations in history, but this one is Rome. Contextually speaking, this is Rome. And certainly no other empire ever dominated the world the way Rome did. And so John sees her revealed as the queen of all prostitutes, who feeds the baser appetites of the Mediterranean world in order to secure her own luxuries. By the way, this idea of whoredom, this idea of fornication, it all depicts God's displeasure with idolatry. And that is true throughout the Bible, in your Old Testament, all these highly figurative prophetic statements about the idolatry of Israel. How she, Ezekiel 18 is very graphic, but it's one of several where Israel is the beautiful bride of God, but she goes and prostitutes herself to all other men to the point that she's paying men to have sex with her. That's all, again, highly figurative, apocalyptic, prophetic type language to communicate idolatry. Israel is engaged in all kinds of gross idolatry. And so John, as I mentioned before, he's heir to a rich prophetic heritage of highly figurative, apocalyptic, prophetic-type language. So guess what he uses? He uses the exact same language. It's just natural that he would use that same imagery here to depict the idolatry of Rome. Rome, you could say Rome was the world's idol in her day. She was a reigning prostitute who seduced and caused others in the whole world to drink of her immorality. And so this is the supreme contrast, the ultimate contrast between good and evil, between the kingdom of Satan and the kingdom of Christ. Now, we should not confuse this woman here that's being depicted in Revelation 17 with the woman that's depicted over in Revelation chapter 12, the one over there, she was also carried off into the wilderness, but it was for a time to be nourished by God for 1260 days. Completely different woman. That woman in chapter 12 was protected by God, represents the church. Here in chapter 17, this woman is the complete opposite of that one. Okay, this is the prostitute of the dragon, as opposed to the bride of Christ that we see over in chapter 12. The beast that she's riding on, same beast as what we saw over in chapter 13 with the 7 heads, the 10 horns, 10 diadems on each horn. I think that comes into play maybe a little later on in chapter 17, but certainly in chapter 13, that's all there. Blasphemous names on each head. Yeah, we see that full of blasphemous names now in verse 3 of Revelation 17. So that sea beast that came out of the sea, as we saw back then, that first beast, and then the second beast that came out of the earth. What we have here, again, highly figurative language of the civil government of Rome with that sea beast, and the false religion of Rome with the earth beast. They have teamed up with this harlot as some kind of unholy trinity. And so this is just awful, awful. She's riding on this crest of absolute world power. She lives in luxuries. She's haughty in splendor. She represents opposition to God at any point in history where power, immorality, debauchery, and corruption reign. I think that's a fair conclusion to make. Beauty, of course, as the old saying goes, is in the eye of the beholder. And the world calls this woman beautiful, and John reveals how overdressed and cheap she really is. All that purple, scarlet, adorned with gold, jewels, pearls, holding a golden cup full of abominations and impurities. Yeah, that's all showing that cheap look. Listen, when the world calls the cheap look beautiful, it's a clear indication that judgment has come. Notice what's written on her forehead, verse 5. On her forehead was written the name of mystery, a name of mystery. Babylon, the great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. So, just bad, bad, grossly immoral, obviously, right? And that mystery, the idea of mystery there, this is a symbolic name, Babylon the Great. That's a symbolic name for Rome. Mother of prostitutes, queen of prostitutes, I already mentioned that earlier. In her hand, again, verse 6, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. What does she have in that golden cup? It's full of the blood of the saints, and she's just drinking it continually. Rome, publicly has had Christians put to death. Nero started with him, but Domitian is really going to kick it up, and that's the reason this judgment comes upon Rome. And really, this picture, she appears to be the victor in every way, right? But she's not. She's going down for the count. The rest of verse 6, when I saw her, I marveled greatly. This is just jaw-dropping what's happening here. So, what's all this then? What's going on here? Verse 7 through the rest of the chapter is going to give us a bit of an explanation here that we've got to weed through and try to figure out. See if we can. But the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns that carries her. Oh, thank goodness. Thank goodness. There's this angel who's assigned to the scene. He's going to help John and us, hopefully, understand what is being seen. John is confused. He's marveling greatly. The angel says, you know, what are you confused about? What are you astonished about? I'm going to explain it to you, what's going on here. And so he first explains the beast that she's riding on, and then he's going to reveal the mystery of the woman herself. What appears to John here covers a chronology of the Roman emperors with the development of the first century Christianity. Okay, he's going to present a chronology here. Today, an astute Bible student can easily see that Daniel's indescribable beast, way back in Daniel chapter 7, go back and listen to the audio of the recording that I did for that. That's undeniably Rome, especially in light of this. You carefully study those things and compare, you see. Now, Nero, he began a policy of persecuting Christians back during his reign in the 60s. The first century, 67, 68, and with his abrupt death in 68 AD, the persecution stopped. Now, there was about a year from 68 to 69 AD where 3 weaker men tried to grab the throne. They're Galba, Otho, and Vitellus, but they were never really able to consolidate the power and hold it, and so in 69... Vespasian, he took the throne, and he'd been leading the Romans into war against the Jews in Jerusalem. And when Galba, Othello, and Vitellus, when they finally kicked the bucket, Vespasian, he comes back to assume that the power of the throne back in Rome. He leaves his son Titus to tidy things up, as it were, in Jerusalem. And so when Vespasian dies in 70 AD, his son Titus comes to power. And then not very long after that, Titus is killed by his own brother. His own brother is named Domitian. And it's Domitian who then assumes the throne over Rome. Domitian is an insane fellow. He was known for attempting to catch flies that were flying around him. He was very jealous, very suspicious of anyone, and he was also homosexual. Now, you remember earlier in this study, I talked about how he assumed the title Kurios Kai Theos, Lord and God. He was ultimately stabbed in the groin 7 times, and that's how he died. And he was also the first emperor to deify himself. The emperors before him would be deified, but after it was posthumous. It was after they died that they were deified. Domitian did it while he was still alive, first emperor to do that. And it's under Domitian that the persecution will be revived with a vengeance. Secular history reads exactly like this. And John wrote about it before it was actually happening, or perhaps in the midst when it was actually happening. And so John, he's here clearly showing just exactly which emperor personifies the beast who would make war against God's people. Okay? That's what we see here. Verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. I believe I've mentioned before Domitian. He is characterized in secular history as Nero reborn. The rebirth, the resurrection of Nero. And so with that idea, Nero, who is dead at the time when John is writing this, Nero was and is not because Domitian has not yet assumed the throne. But he will. He's coming back out of the bottomless pit, and then he will go to destruction. Okay? His doom is sealed. The dwellers on earth, those who are not worshipers of God, the dwellers on earth whose names are not, who have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast. Because it was, again, that's Nero, and is not, because Vespasian and then Titus will rule for a few years, and is to come. To come is Domitian. He's coming back. And so this calls for a mind with wisdom. That's why those, you know, those who would try to read into this some kind of futuristic, yet future fulfillment, that's unwise. That's foolish. That's folly. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. Rome was built upon 7 hills, by the way. And then there are also 7 kings. It's interesting. 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen. One is, the other has yet to come. And when he comes, he must remain for a little while. A couple of years, that's Titus. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an 8th and belongs to the 7th, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These 10 kings appear to be quite possibly. Actually, before I get to that, let me deal with these the 7 heads. I kind of ran through that. The 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen. The 5 who have fallen are Augustus, Caligula, Nero, Tiberius, and Claudius. The one who is, that's Vespasian. The other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain only a little while. That's Titus. And according to my notes, he only reigned about 2 years. And then the beast that was and is not and is to and is it is an 8th. That's Domitian. He's the 8th in this. Now, counting the emperors, this can be tricky. Counting the kings, there are some who want to start the count with Julius Caesar. That's not right. Julius, here's a few reasons why. It is true that some of the ancient writers did count Caesar as the first emperor. Suetonius does in a section that he writes about Vespasian. Josephus does in his Antiquities. But, again, here are a few reasons. Number one, Caesar, Julius Caesar, ruled under the Republic. It is Augustus who is the first to rule under the empire. There's a difference there. Also, Caesar, Julius Caesar, was only one of many previous dictators. Augustus is the first to take the title Princeps, the principled, the first. Now, while, again, like I said, other ancient writers do count Julius Caesar as the first emperor, there are other writers who acknowledged Augustus as the first emperor. Tacitus, in particular, who was a Roman historian, he counts Augustus as the first. And then, starting with Augustus, the count fits very well with identifying the short reign of Titus, who rules about, again, 2 years, 79 to 81. And he's the seventh king who is to remain only a short time. Now, it is true that you have Galba, Otho, and Vitellus in there for that one-year period. But despite the fact that they each ruled briefly as the official emperor, none, again, successfully consolidated that power. And they only ruled ultimately for about a year, year and a half. And many ancient and modern authors skip those three in their enumeration. That's how minimal they are. And in fact, when you go back into Daniel chapter 7, verses 7 and 8, and the interpretation is given in verse 24 of that chapter, speaks of the 10 kings plus one king minus three kings, three that are uprooted, that leaves eight. Daniel saw it back then with that indescribable beast, and now here it is, come to fruition, prophecy fulfilled here with Rome and these seven heads, these seven kings that are also the seven hills, kings of Rome, the seven hills that it's built on, all that stuff. So that's how you count these kings here in Revelation. A little different than what you see over in Daniel, but still related. Now, these 10 kings who received power for a little while, 10 kings without a kingdom, they're going to have power for 1 hour, just a very brief time. They probably represent maybe vassal kings like Herod, or they represent these other kingdoms that were allied with Rome. That certainly would include Herod in that. But they're provinces, they're nations which are under the Roman rule. They are separate provincial powers within the kingdom, but Rome has conquered them, and in turn, Rome has delegated authority to them for a short time, just that 1 hour, and they're serving as Roman allies, as satellite nations. And they're going to help Rome make war against the church as well. Let's read verse 13. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. Rome's conquered them. Verse 14, they will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called chosen and faithful. The Lamb is going to overcome. That's the bottom line. The Lamb and his followers, they will be victorious. Verse 15, the angel said to me, the waters you saw are where the prostitute is seated are peoples, multitudes, and nations, and languages. The ten horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. Remember the feet of iron and clay in Daniel chapter 2? Well, that's exactly what you're seeing here with Rome, with the mixing of the other nations. They're going to rise up in rebellion. For, verse 17, God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purposes by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman, Rome, that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. So that is how you interpret chapter 17. Let's get to the sponsor for this half hour. Merced Church of Christ, located at 2050 Yosemite Parkway. The Merced Church of Christ is composed of people devoted to the Word of God, people devoted to the worship of God, and people devoted to the work of God. Our purpose is to see as many people as possible following Jesus as closely as possible, all toward a more united fellowship. The Merced Church of Christ meets every Lord's Day, that's Sunday, for Bible study at 9:30 a.m., morning worship at 10:30 a.m., and evening worship at 6 p.m. We also meet for midweek Bible study every Wednesday at 7 p.m. She's served by yours truly, her preaching minister, Nick Perez. Go online and visit www.mercedchurchofchrist.org. Merced Church of Christ, making and maturing disciples.
And now it's time for the question of the day. This is the question of the day on Life from the Pulpit.
Is the Bible historically reliable? Great question. I'm going to deal with it today and tomorrow in the Question of the Day segment. Christianity is an historical religion. The atoning death of Jesus Christ on the cross is only as real as the historical event itself. If Christianity is to have any dynamic for changing lives and creating genuine hope for a future life, then it's necessary to view the New Testament as a record of actual factual historical events. In the words of one of my instructors, Brother Ed Wharton, faith and history cannot be divorced without destroying the real power of Christianity. For to remove faith from its historical basis is to remove Christ from his power to save from sin and to raise the dead. Now, the evidence for the historical reliability, the historicity of the Bible is overwhelming. Over 23,000 archaeological discoveries have been made which only affirm that the Bible tells the truth about historical events. In fact, there's on the market now, you can get an archaeological study Bible in either New International Version or King James Version. I've seen those versions available. Literally hundreds of articles and references of various historical persons, places, or events are referenced there. As you are reading the Bible, right alongside you have these notes showing you all these different archaeological discoveries. So it's fascinating, just overwhelming testimony to the historical reliability that when you read that someone said or did something in history from the Bible, they said or did that particular thing. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about here. They're interesting to me. Hopefully they're interesting to you. One from the Old Testament, one from the New Testament. And you'll see what I'm talking about. In the Old Testament, you will read about a nation of people called the Hittites. In fact, they're the people that Abraham buys a burial plot for his wife Sarah when she dies in Genesis 23. He buys it from the Hittites. But they're all over the Old Testament. Well, for a long time, skeptical scholars would point to the Hittites as being a mythical creation of the Old Testament writers due to the fact that there was no extra-biblical mention of the Hittites. Nothing outside the Bible that they could find. So archaeologists dug a little deeper, and lo and behold, what do they find? In 1876, A.H. Sayce, and later in 1906, Hugo Winkler, discovered a Hittite library in central Turkey, which contained law codes, legends, covenants, various Hittite myths, and this discovery established the historicity of a kingdom that the Old Testament Bible writers knew existed all along, much to the chagrin of skeptics. So that's the Old Testament. I'll give you a New Testament example here. You read about a guy in the New Testament named Pontius Pilate. You ever hear of him? Yeah, I heard him. He's in the New Testament. He, of course, has the ignoble epithet of being the man who sentenced Jesus to crucifixion. Now, like the Hittites, skeptics would jump all over Pontius Pilate because of a lack of extra-biblical mention. They couldn't find anything mentioned about Pilate outside of the New Testament. That was a cause for doubt among these skeptical scholars. They said you should doubt the Bible as historically reliable as a result. That is, until Antonio Frova and a group of Italian archaeologists dug up the Pilate Stone in June of 1961. It's dated around 26 to 37 AD, and there's a Latin inscription which reads, Tiberium Pontius Pilate, Prefect of Judea, and it's the only archaeological evidence giving Pilate's name and title. So they finally found it. Examples like that could continue, but I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. I always like to hear what you have to say. Also, search Facebook for the Life from the Pulpit Facebook page. Like that page. You get all the updates when I go live with a podcast or update the blog. Or when I post a new video to YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube, Life from the Pulpit, and subscribe to the YouTube channel, Life from the Pulpit YouTube channel, and see all the Question of the Day segments there. Be sure to stop by the Life from the Pulpit blog, www.lifefromthepulpit.wordpress.com. All my commentary there on Luke, James, 1 John, all there, all available, all free for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Now I'm on iTunes. Search the iTunes store for the Life from the Pulpit podcast. Get all the episodes downloaded to your particular iDevice. You'll never be more than a click away from the episodes of the podcast. Check out Merced Church of Christ website, mercedchurchofchrist.org, mercedchurchofchrist.org. Plenty of sermon audio there to help you grow in your daily walk as well. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.